Hello everyone and welcome to yet another, I could probably say that now, yet another episode of The Rut, where we explore two new depths in many instances, the world of men's mental health, and try to find answers to some of the burning questions which are ever present in this area by exploring people's minds. We're not just a podcast anymore as well, we're also a YouTube channel, so do go onto YouTube and type in The Rut, where you will find all of our episodes from season 2, or I think most of them now. We've got Alistair Campbell's up on there, Joe Bryan, Luke Tabersky, Nick E, David Birtwistle, etc. So it's a pretty good watch, and I'm excited for us to deliver more and more cool content. And explore this world even further on YouTube, and bring you more stories from real people who many of you may be quite unsuspecting who have suffered. I think this week's episode is firmly one for the rugby purists. We recorded this episode in September, so really at the end of the last lockdown when the rugby season was restarting again. So I'm actually a little bit gutted that we didn't, that I didn't know he was going to referee the 2020 Premiership Final in October. Anyway, I'm really, really, really pleased that I got to sit down with this fabulous, fabulous guy, actually, who many of you might not really know, but those of you in the rugby circles will know him as one of the top referees in England. Like I said, he was the man in the middle for the Premiership Final this year, in which Exeter, very sadly, because I'm a Wasps fan, but Exeter Chiefs beat Wasps. In 2019, he revealed he was gay, opening up his sexuality to the game, to professional sport, and to the world for the first time, and the reaction has been absolutely fantastic, which is testament to the... to rugby as a sport being so inclusive so much of the time. He's been a professional referee for over 6 years, but it was recently that we sat down and talked about, again for the first time, about the difficulties he's had with his mental health, which left him unable to do the job he loved to do for a while whilst he sorted all out. So I am very, very excited to explore this man's story for the first time publicly. Let's get into this one with Craig Maxwell Keys. Here's Craig's story. So as always, please leave all judgment at the door. Craig, welcome to The Rut.
Thank you.
How are you?
Not too bad, thank you. 4 games into a restart, so busy would be an understatement, but probably can't complain considering we've had 5 months off.
I know. What were you doing in that 5 months? What were you doing in lockdown, I should probably say?
Lockdown was actually really good. I suppose everyone had a list of DIY projects. So we literally had 8 weeks of DIY, from repairing the fences that were blown down in the gales, to laying the Victorian path that's out the front, to replacing the fence out the front, doing the garden out the front. And then we had a load of pallets that all the timber and stones had come on. So I built a cold frame and a shoe rack. So I sort of resurrected my GCSE resistant materials.
Busy, yeah.
Really busy. So by the time we'd done all that, lockdown was easing. So it was actually timed perfectly.
Very nice. Very nice. I ask this question to everybody who comes on the pod. You've listened to a few episodes now, I think. And why did you want to come on?
Yeah, I saw the pod through Instagram, gave a few of them a listen, liked a few of the videos. I think you then dropped me a message through Instagram, and I was more than happy to come on, keen to come on, just as it's a great platform to get people talking, which, yeah, linked to the LGBT stuff from my perspective is something I'm keen to do.
Very good. Very nice. Let's talk about Craig Maxwell Keys growing up and the kind of pathway into rugby. You had you were fast-tracked, really, by the RFU into refereeing, but intellectual guy who studied chemical engineering?
Just chemistry.
Chemistry.
It's a sore point, actually. So other half do chemical engineering.
Right, okay.
So, yeah, us chemists come up with all the good ideas, is what I say. Then you hand it over to the engineers who can't scale it up and ruin it as a concept. So, yeah, that's a point of banter in this house, I'd say.
Very nice. So, yeah, talk to me about Craig growing up.
Yeah, so in terms of the fast track, that very much started. So injury got me into refereeing in the first place.
Right, okay.
Purely because I'm a rubbish spectator. So you talk about the RFU having its game values initiatives. I'd be the person watching my team play, shouting, screaming, getting frustrated. So I had to do something to get involved. So ran touch. That then got me onto a refereeing course. As soon as I could play again, I played. Then got injured again. So you're like, right, okay, maybe someone's trying to tell me something here. So that's when refereeing started properly. Right time, right place, because my high school's business manager sort of ran the local ref society.
Mm.
So he was really persuasive. And thankfully, I listened to him because it clearly launched a decent enough career from a refereeing perspective, more so than if I'd been a player. Mm. But yeah, the fast track thing's interesting because I think compared to some, definitely fast tracked. But I've still spent a year at every level of the game from level 6 onwards.
You started refereeing at 16, right?
16, yeah. So, yeah, some have done it faster. Well, some unfortunately never make it. But still a year at every level of the game, which isn't as fast as some people perceive a fast track to be.
And let's talk about rugby back then. I mean, we're talking from a 40-year-old's perspective right now. You're pretty young. But how has rugby changed since 16, 17-year-old Craig picked up a whistle?
Oh, geez, there's been so many changes, hasn't there? I mean, the laws are always being tinkered with. Sometimes they yield some good outcomes, particularly when it's player safety that motivates it. But like the different scrum sequences that I've had to engage a scrum would have changed massively. And I think you still have the same old problem, which is in the community game, the scrums work. The ball comes in, the ball goes out, and we get on with playing rugby. In this pro game, they're a problem because they're seen as a means to try and manipulate and win penalties depending on different teams, different conditions. So that problem still remains. That hasn't changed.
Mm.
The breakdown's clearly evolved. I think even before the current directives came in around just reapplying law, the breakdown was getting quicker. More ball in play was being seen, very much fitting in with it being an entertainment sport in the entertainment industry. So it's got to be, you've got to keep people interested, attract new people in, and that's how you do it. That has changed and evolved, and then players getting bigger. I think that's something I've seen and noticed, mainly because I need to stay out of the way of them because it hurts when you get in the way. That's the motivating factor there for me, but that's probably another change that's rolled on. So yeah, some for the better, some for the worse.
I want to talk about Craig Maxwell Keyes, the personality, because I had a chat, as you know, we spoke before this podcast I wouldn't call it that, a relatively mutual friend in refereeing, right? You've known him longer than I have, albeit. And he said something quite interesting, which was he's known you for a while when you were coming through the ranks, and you're very much like him in terms of like process-driven, technically proficient.
Yeah.
So give me a... paint a picture of Craig Maxwell Keyes as the personality and thinker and how your brain works.
I'm a very analytical person.
Mm.
So that we're all sort of profiled in the group. And funnily enough, the one we did, I came out as blue, which is as analytical as you can be. So I'm more someone who you can present me with a situation, a number of scenarios. I would quite happily take it away, analyse it, think about it, run through all the different permutations and all the different answers, and then I'll come back to you given time and tell you what the best course of action is. That would be my preferred way of doing things, which is quite ironic when you then consider on the pitch, you've got to make instantaneous decisions. You don't have that time to go through things. And that level of rigour and order then probably reflects the personal side of me as well, which is probably not OCD, but like there's a very efficient way that I like to store things. If you look at my desk, everything's in a very set place. And that was endless pranks at university of people breaking into your room and just putting everything at 45 degree angles.
Oh my God.
And it would just stress me out until everything was back where it needed to be. great for seeing when your brother's stolen something or gone rummaging through your drawers back at home, but equally annoying when your uni mates are constantly doing that to you.
100%.
But yeah, it's interesting. Different refs, completely different in terms of their approach and their personality. But yeah, I'm very much from a process-driven background.
Mm. And that's, look, without being funny, refereeing, you are a big group of people. Well, not big, but you're a close-knit group of people.
Yeah.
But there's also a hierarchy, realistically, there. How does that impact you?
Hierarchy.
Mm.
I think the key thing there is it's close-knit, and that hierarchy doesn't really come across as a hierarchy. It's basically everyone's really open, everyone's really honest. Some of our best conversations go on in the gym because there's no formal structure to that meeting, but natural conversations just happen, and you can really delve into detail behind why people give certain decisions, people's broader philosophy on their approach to the game if a certain situation's happened at a weekend and they've dealt with it different to you. So I think, yeah, the hierarchy exists is that if you want an answer to a particular clip, you know who to go to, either because they can give you the answer or they can get in contact with the big wigs, if you like, who can give you the answer. But from a concept of sharing ideas and thoughts, the group's really open and really transparent. And no one puts themselves above anyone else. It's a very even playing field when it comes to having discussions and valuing different people's view, which ultimately I think is why the group is so successful, because it's a good culture to have that.
Refereeing as a job is very fascinating, actually, because
at least you call it a job.
Well, it is for you. It is
100%.
It's your full time. I was sat there in the car on the way here thinking, right, refereeing. I can imagine when you are refereeing, let's say, Heineken Cup, Toulouse Wasps, sat in a hotel room, the game's happened, but then you know that you've, at some stage in that game, may have fucked up somewhere.
Sounds very familiar.
Yeah. Made a call, made a decision, which has actually had an impact on the game and the outcome.
Yep.
And you're being pumped potentially from all different angles on social media. You're then given a review of the game, potentially almost after the game when you're sitting in a hotel room. I can imagine it's quite a lonely place.
No, yeah, 100%. It can be. We're lucky that we travel normally as a team of four.
Right.
So there's always people around you who know you really well, so they'll know if there's been a big decision or you're down because a particular moment's changed the outcome of a game, and they'll certainly G around, or they won't let a situation exist when you're stuck in your hotel room on your
right,
own.
Okay. I was going to ask how do you even cope with that, because net refereeing is a often thankless job. You don't really find in the media that you get any reports on, or even from coaches or fans saying, oh fucking hell, Craig Maxwell Keys had an awesome game today. It's very rare.
Yeah, if you wanted that popularity, then yeah, you'd certainly need to find a different career.
Precisely, yeah.
I think it depends what motivates you. So like, the reasons that I went into refereeing and I still do it today is because I enjoy a challenge.
Right.
So I enjoy seeing, right, how does my skill set pit against this game, what it throws at me, and how quickly can my skills adapt to fit in with what this game needs. And you'll always be found wanting, but that means you've always got things where you can improve and you can get better. And I think you just have to accept as part of that, same as the players will make mistakes, same as coaches will make mistakes, we all make mistakes. Some of them, unfortunately, will be bigger than others. But it's how you come back from them. And that's the thing that excites me. And I think it's very rarely, okay, yes, if you look at any decision in isolation, it's wrong, it's a two-point game, you give an incorrect penalty, that's 3 points. But that's how the media will portray it. But I think the more rational part of my brain basically goes, hang on a second, there's been 80 minutes of rugby happened here. That's 80 minutes of decision-making by me, the players and the coaches. And if you go back for a game, you'll see a missed tackle by a player that leads to 7 points. Mm. You'll see potentially, I don't know, the front row get changed and then that changes the whole scrum dynamic and they lose penalties then at the scrum, which cost them points. So then if you start to add up the swing and balance of things throughout a game, yes, in isolation, that decision's cost them a game because it's in the 79th minute. But over the course of a game, actually, there's a hell of a lot of other stuff gone on, which if the team had have executed what they were meant to have done, I wouldn't have impacted the outcome of a game. Mm. So if you look at it rationally, that's how I look at it. Many people probably won't, but that gives me a source of comfort. And then second to that, it's a case of just, we will make mistakes, but provided you don't keep making them, then you're a better referee for it.
It's an interesting thought process, because there's kind of two things that I would love to touch on there. One is the whole like resilience aspect of refereeing, because you need to be hugely resilient, and I can imagine that that's where a lot of referees just have fallen short. They may have been, it may have been identified that just not resilient enough. They can't take the negative feedback that's not just coming from, let's say, I don't know, Chris White or Tony Spreadbury, that's coming from the coaches, the players, the fans, and most arguably most importantly, you yourself. How have you developed resilience throughout your career so far? Because this is going to be fascinating.
I think you just have to keep getting back out there. And you have to just sum up whatever it is you need to sum up, and have the right people around you to get you back out there. And because the game that probably jumps to mind for everyone goes back a few years, the Northampton Wasps game, where I red card Nathan Hughes in the first half. I genuinely did not want to come out of that half after half time out of the dressing room.
Really?
I could quite happily have stayed in there and just made up some absolutely rubbish reasons to why I couldn't go back out there. But that would have been the worst thing that could have happened.
But why? Because the decision, it was... Because I remember it well, being a Wasps fan, and
so does the Wasps owner.
Spoke
to him the other day.
Oh my god! So it was a marginal decision. Really, could have gone either way. Yeah. And actually, it's kind of subjective in those.
I think I was ahead of my time. Where we are now with
contact
to the head, I was a few years ahead of my time. At the time, a bit more debatable.
It's a big decision to make. Were you shitting yourself before you got brought out that red card? Or were you going through the process in your head?
If that's straight, you default to process. And then one area where I think I am in my element is TMO. Because going back to what I made earlier, you've got a chance, albeit not as much time as we'd want, but you've got 90 seconds, 2 minutes to look at the replays and to apply a process to it. And if you're clear in your own mind, and that's where preparation helps massively. If you haven't, as an individual, sort of role played, how am I going to deal with these scenarios? What am I going to say? What factors am I going to consider, and in what order? Then you can have all the replays you like. You'll still arrive at a rubbish decision. But if you've given that some thought and done the proper preparation, then the process just naturally starts to flow. And it doesn't matter whether you're stood in front of one person or 1,000. You it's no different. You're trapped in that process.
How do you deal with that pressure by the process?
The pressure? I think...
Because whether you like it or not, whether you're stood in front of about 500 people at the AJ Bell, or
they're getting more people there now,
or 25,000 people potentially at Welford Road, it's a pressure cooker often.
Yeah, I think I got an interesting view on pressure. Like, some people thrive under pressure, or they'd say they thrive under pressure. Being the data nors that I am, there's not a lot of data out there that suggests people thrive under pressure. Everyone under pressure will perform worse. You just need to perform not as bad as everyone else. So everyone's going to drop their level of performance under pressure, is what a lot of data would suggest. But provided you mitigate that as far as possible.
Why?
Under pressure. Just because, like, if you go and execute a skill on a training ground, when it's more natural, it's more carefree, you don't overthink it. The second you're in a pressurized environment and you're desperate to succeed, it's very easy to start overthinking things. And then the mechanics break down. So if you're overthinking something that's intuitive and natural, which you could do without thinking, and that's when you do it at its best, because it is a natural skill set. If you overthink it, overanalyze it, and you break it back down, you almost go back to a toddler when you're learning to do something and you're trial and error. So I think in those pressurized environments, it's very easy to overthink, overanalyze, and that's when you're going to start tripping over yourself.
Did that happen? Your first game was at the Rico, right?
First Premiership game.
Televised Premiership.
Televised, people often make that mistake.
What was your first Premiership game?
First Premiership game came up at Newcastle. So Newcastle played Exeter. Right. So it was the end of the previous season.
Right, okay.
So that's the one game I did as a non-full-timer.
Right.
And followed the Army-Navy from the week before.
So you did that at Twickenham, right?
Did the Army Navy at Twickenham, probably one of the career highlights.
Really?
Because it's 80,000 people at Twickenham. Yeah. So it's very few people get to step out at Twickenham.
What was your first game with a TMO?
With a TMO?
Yeah.
It would have been that game.
Okay. And talk to me about that game, because for anybody, that's a huge moment in their life.
It's massive, yeah.
Yeah.
I think the best advice for that one was just, look, just enjoy it and the rest will happen.
Yeah, of course.
And having 82,000 people sing the national anthem. Yeah. So even when you get an international there,
it's amazing.
Not everyone's singing the anthem because you've got your away fans there. When it's the Army Navy, everyone is singing the anthem, and that's such an iconic moment on that pitch. Stood there listening to that with a band behind you. If you're not enjoying that and you're not nervous by that, I'd be concerned.
Mm. But you talk about pressure there, because that any human, that means a lot to anybody.
100%.
This is what they think their professional career is going to be, and you're stepping out in front of 82,000 people for the first time with the TMO. It's your first time with 82,000 people. It's not as if it's just a friendly either. This is a full-blown match. So I've been to Army Navy for several times. It's a full-blown game with some very, very good ex-professionals in there as well.
Yeah.
That's pressure.
Yeah, it is. And I suppose you mentioned earlier, some people make it, some people don't. And I think that's where it comes down to. That's almost the acid test. It's like, how do you thrive under not?
Were you worried before that game?
I'm concerned if I wasn't.
Yeah, of course.
You're constantly petrified about a whole host of things. Like, well, this is now on live TV, so if anything goes wrong here, it's now a case of...
Lioness is your first televised game, actually.
This is going to instantly go onto Twitter, onto social media. So there's going to be newspaper reports about it. So that's the first game I'd done where that was a real... It was going to happen as a consequence of it. So yeah, you can worry about all those things, but I can't control any of that.
Mm.
The only thing that I can control is how I prepare for that game and how I go and referee that game.
Mm.
And if it was anything to go by how the games had gone the week before, which is why I had that appointment in the first place, then it was going to go well. So if I looked after what I could control and deal with that, then I had no reason to doubt the outcome would be positive.
Right.
And if it wasn't, as I said earlier, then I'd back myself to learn from that. That's where I find the challenge in it.
Back yourself. Very interesting term. A lot of people don't.
Yeah, I don't always back myself.
Right, okay.
Depending what context you're talking about, yeah, I wouldn't always back myself.
Right.
But in that skill that is refereeing, my job, then that's something I've got a lot of confidence in, and I would back myself. If I don't get it right the first time, I'm damn well going to learn to get it right the second time. So in that very niche sort of circumstance or situation, I'd back myself there.
No doubting, very smart guy, technically very proficient. Not a huge personality within the refereeing scene. Not like your JPs, your Nigel Owens, and your Wayne Barnes.
Yeah. Not getting one-liners from me on the pitch going viral.
Yeah, and to some extent, Luke Pearce.
For his fake tan.
Yeah. but there must... You're only human.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to know... I want to talk about a couple of games. And I actually... There's only... I actually don't know... We haven't spoken about this before, but I'd love to know whether there's been a few games in your career when you've sat there. Obviously, the Northampton Wasps game at Franklin's Gardens where you sent off Nathan Hughes, unjustifiably. comes to mind. But those games where you've sat in the changing rooms after knowing that, fuck, something's happened here, and you've felt the pressure, you've felt potentially your mental health slipping, anxiety coming in. Has there been any instances there?
The one that jumps to mind, I did a European game in Edinburgh and gave a shocking red card. It was an awful decision. And that's the only time in my career, really, where I've sat there even a week after it's happened. Because normally, straight after the game, there's still emotions driving what you're thinking about. And I know, being the process analytical guy I am, you can't make sound decisions with emotions flooding through your head.
No.
So you need an element of... It's quite interesting when we sit down and analyse games again 4 weeks after they've happened, you can come up with some very different conclusions and perceptions, because you're detached from the emotion of the game, you're detached from the vested interest you have in the review going well. But yeah, so even a week after that game, I was, and that red card from Edinburgh, I was still scratching my head going, how is it possible that I gave that decision? And you seriously then, I was questioning.
What happened?
So this came in. This was when there was a whole load of press around contact with the head and protecting player welfare. So that was the first time when this became sort of a big news story and the wheel started rolling to where we are now with protecting player welfare and the head. So then the second we had a ruck and a player basically lashed out and slapped someone around the head. So you're like, well, he's hit him in the head. Doesn't matter, it's a slap, still contact to the head. So the process-driven person I am, applying law to the dotted I and the cross T, devoid of any context or empathy, with all these directives whizzing around the back of your head that has been in the press for the last few weeks, you go, well, there's your red card. And you look back at it and go, the guy pleaded guilty and got a week. So you can argue, okay, fine, that's, okay, it's not a decision that's been overturned. But in reality, that's rubbish. You could quite easily, and what should have happened is, because there's another guy involved, two yellow cards would have dealt with it sufficiently. Mm. And everyone would have gone, right, can't do that, dealt with it well, good empathy, crack on. But instead I go OTT, which showed a complete lack of empathy, lack of game understanding. So then you start questioning your broader like philosophies to the game. And it's the only time I fundamentally question, why am I doing this? Am I cut out to do this? If I think that's a red card...
But why did that have such an impact?
I think because
it came, like you said earlier, you are going to make mistakes.
I think it came at a point where I thought I was making progress. And right. When you think you're making progress and you think like you're progressing quite nicely up the tiers, you're starting to get recognition, you've got people on side, and then you go and do something like that. Mm. It very much was going against the grain, was a complete bolt out the blue and a very big reality check. But then in hindsight, you look back at it and go, it's the best thing that ever happened to me. Because I spoke to so many people at that time, not about anything technical, just about like what philosophy you bring into the game, what guides your decision making.
What did they say?
It was the same old debate. Like, you've got the law book, but some people won't like us saying this, but the law is probably about 30% of our job. 70% of it is how you manage a game, manage people, and communicate,
interpret the laws.
And then you can, because the same as in any law, Wayne could tell you from a legal perspective. Whether it's criminal law, it's all open to interpretation. And that's how lawyers make a nice career, in a courtroom arguing the nuances of law. It's the same in rugby. There's very rarely will you get a clip where, yes, that's the answer, let's move on. There's so many shades of grey on it. So then what's going to guide you given one decision or the next when you can justify both? And then what came out of that was, trust my gut instinct and don't be a prescriptive referee. So we'll be given guidelines, we're given laws, but we've got to apply them. Mm. We've got to interpret them. We're out there in the middle of that game. We can understand better than anyone the temperament of that game. And it's how you then apply that, the law, the directives, to what does that game need based on that day and that moment.
The role of the TMO is actually quite interesting because from a fan's perspective... Yeah, there are some decisions where I'm like, fucking hell, Craig, what are you doing? And you've
just
gone yeah, you've gone to the TMO, and the TMO has kind of not really... he's guided you up to a point. Say, in your ear, Craig, I think you should look at this. Okay, let's go through the process. Do you think... Well, from a fan's perspective, I would say that if you're going to get something quite obviously wrong, even if it's so it's open to interpretation, the TMO surely has a duty potentially of care to the referees to just be like, are you sure about that, Craig? You see very little of that going on, actually. When I know, obviously, the referee's decision is sacrosanct, but also you bring in your assistant refs. But the kind of TMO should be sat there who's in front of these camera screens being like, I'm not sure about that one.
Yeah, I think... Yeah, we're trying to get better at that, in the sense that I think we've made great progress. So there has to be a challenge culture in the group. So if we go down one route on field and the TMO disagrees with us, he has to be able to tell us. So I completely agree with that. But equally, it's not the TMO's job to constantly mop up mistakes that we make. So if we make a decision, and I think most of us as pro refs are really good at explaining why we've done something. So good that we then take a load of people along with us and convince them that we're right. And if that happens with the TMO, so if he sat there going, oh geez, this goes one way or the other, our explanation's so good and so clear that he buys what we've said, he's never then going to challenge us. But yeah, there's certainly instances where we go down the wrong route on field, and it happened to me in a game recently at Wasps Sale. I'm just going to give a penalty for an incident. It wasn't even the TMO that saved me, it was the AR just going, mate, you need to look at this again. Is this not just cynical?
Really?
And so that's the challenge culture we want. But it's remembering that we're the decision maker, and if we get it wrong, it's our fault. But if our team then saves us, it's not necessarily their job to, but it's great that they do. But yeah, it's it's an interesting point around how they can help us and assist in decision making, but yeah. Then they can't correct everything.
No. But I think there's a fine line. I accept they can't be like, no, sorry, you're wrong. You need to change that. Albeit that does happen to a degree in cricket, actually. But a referee's job and life on the pitch, I think, would be made a whole lot easier if there is such an overt decision that's quite clearly wrong.
Yep.
Yet the TMO often says nothing. It's just like, yep, go with your decision.
I think, yeah, when it's to do with foul play, I think I'd agree. On technical matters, they can't.
No.
They can't come in because there'd be so many technical things that they could come in for. You'd have no flow and continuity.
No, of course.
But I think, yeah, from a foul play perspective, if we're clearly wrong, then to be fair, I think it starts with our assistant referees.
Right, okay.
So they can see the big screen in the stadium. So the challenge should start there.
Mm.
And that's certainly something I'm aware of going into this weekend when I'm on touch.
Mm.
Slightly different role that we're not necessarily used to.
Mm.
But we've got a massive responsibility, not just at downtime to be stood there twiddling our thumbs, but we can look at the screen and see what's there.
Of course.
So we can challenge as much as the TMO.
Mm.
It's something that we've, as I said, we're making great strides on. But I suppose the ultimate strength of a group is when anyone can challenge anyone on anything.
Mm.
As you say, it's all about getting the right outcome.
Mm. That's interesting you say that with assistant referees and the right outcome. You weren't obviously, I presume you weren't in New Zealand at the time, but the Lions Tour,
mm-hmm.
2017. It was 2017, right? It was, yeah.
Potentially, yeah. I remember I was in Israel at the time refereeing.
Right, okay, yeah. Sure. So, Lions Tour 2017, final test. Roman Poit, it's the 79th minute, and obviously the famous moment where Ken Owens does or doesn't grab the ball in an offside position,
yep.
with the Lions hanging on by their fingernails to a draw. And initially, Roman Poit gives a penalty, doesn't mm-hmm. he? And then he gets a word in his ear. Obviously, I don't know whether you know what's happened there in terms of what's been said in the ear through off on the grapevine of within the refereeing world. But you've then got a situation where in such high pressure stakes, Roman yep. Poit's given a penalty, and I think it was Jerome Garcés who's in his ear said,
"Are you sure?"
Like,
yeah.
As from a refereeing perspective, it was quite clear that, I mean, Ken Owens has got away with one there.
Yeah, I think those situations are interesting.
Do you know what was said?
I don't know the specifics, probably in French, and my French is useless, so
of course.
I couldn't begin to tell
you. Have you heard on the grapevine what was said?
Not the specifics, and if I have, I've long since forgotten.
Okay. That's a shame.
But those scenarios are almost treated in isolation, because you mentioned earlier, like, we can be absolutely panned for giving an incorrect decision that cost a team a game. Mm. So then our TMO protocol has to be flexible enough to allow us in what is clearly not just a game defining, but a series defining moment,
an extraordinary moment to get
the right outcome. Mm. And this thing goes back to Craig Joubert and the World Cup scenario, where at the time,
hell,
the TMO protocol does not allow you to go near that. Whereas if you look at where we are now, the situation's evolved to a point of, this is such a big decision, which is clearly going to be pivotal in the game. If our TMO protocol doesn't allow us to get this right, then the protocol is not fit for purpose. And that's probably where that has changed, to allow us then to get those big decisions right. Because if we don't get that right, we know what the headlines are going to be on Monday morning or even that evening. And that compromises the whole game's credibility.
Yeah, I mean, that moment, Craig Joubert was quite extraordinary as well. Yeah. And then running off the pitch, he says to have a wee. I'm not...
Well, I think there's no right or wrong answer to that. I think you can see the argument there for wanting to diffuse what's clearly going to be a highly emotional scenario.
Of course.
And if we'd had a situation on the pitch where players had been confronting and openly challenging a referee, those images going around the world would have looked awful and been completely contrary to the game values. So I can see the benefits as to why he did what he did and the decision making that he had to make on the spot to make that decision. So I can understand why that happened.
Very on message. Are you an introvert or an extrovert?
Introvert. Like, my birthday in lockdown, 30th, loved it.
There's a lot of people. I used to think I was an extrovert. With lockdown, I've realised, you know what, there's some weeks, and to be honest, months where I'm like, well, I've realised through lockdown that if I didn't have to see another person for the next 6 years, I would be sweet.
Yeah.
But I just want to touch on being an introvert in rugby and refereeing, because refereeing, you get a lot of shit.
Yep.
Almost all the time. And actually, it's quite a negative job when you think about it and you strip it back. And I can see the cogs turning in your head right now. But it is quite a negative job. I mean, you're sat reviewing a game and literally all you're looking at is for the mistakes you've made. And you're not often praised for the good decisions. I'm sure you are. Well, you've said, yeah, you've got that right. Well,
it's done. It's interesting. So at the weekend, actually, the commentators an hour in compliment me on how I've reffed the game up to that point. Very rarely does that happen, but it's nice when it does. But then the commentator's curse definitely exists. The same for us as it is for players.
100%.
Because 10 seconds later, I nearly get wiped out.
Yeah.
And then the very next penalty I go and give is completely wrong. The first incorrect decision of the game. Mm. So you're sort of like, nice that that's happened, and it doesn't happen often. So clutch at it when it does. But yeah, the commentator's curse in that instance definitely struck.
Mm. Going back to the introvert versus kind of extrovert debate, because you see this extroverted referees, I would argue Nigel Owens up to a point, or how it perceives. I'd love to talk to Nigel on the pod as well, so if he's listening, please do get in touch.
I'll get him to listen.
Yeah, I mean, I'd love that. But JP Doyle, big personality. Wayne Barnes, probably quite an introverted extrovert, or it comes across with a media profile. Luke Pearce, I can imagine being a bit of an extrovert. But if you're always getting shit as a referee and you're a process-driven introvert like you are, how do you have such like a Teflon nature to shrug all the shit that comes with being a referee off?
Perspective?
Right, okay.
So, yeah, I think perspective is a massive thing. I don't think necessarily it's the perspective that I give it. But as you said, so from a science background, from a pharma background, a large number of my uni friends, while interested in what I do, aren't sports fans.
Right.
So I can referee a game, and back when I was at uni, you'd rock back in at your university digs and they wouldn't give a damn about what. You could have just given the worst decision ever and cost the team a game. They don't care. They're not talking about it, they're not interested, they're straight back into talking about other stuff. Which again just gives you that perspective that while on the pitch for 80 minutes, that's the biggest thing that ever exists. When I get back into my social circle, it's very much viewed as, well, that's just a game and there's bigger things going on in life, to put that into perspective. And that's, I think that's how you develop a bit of, I don't think it's Teflon skin, but you, whatever is being thrown at you, you can diffuse it as a big issue because you can see how it fits into the wider life and society.
And social media as a referee?
Well, I'm not on Twitter.
That,
so that removes
100% for the best,
because removes a shed load.
Yeah, I don't know if it, well, Andy Goob was bagging me the other day on Twitter, which is not uncommon because he loves to bag everyone. But yeah, I mean, social media from a referee's perspective, probably Twitter is brilliant. And I obviously, if I didn't search you on Instagram as Craig Maxwell Keys, I would never know who you were from your profile. But surely social media can cause mental health issues within the refereeing community.
I think it can cause it with any community. Because if all you, it's the same with anything, isn't it? If all you want to do is look at the negatives, and if all you're doing is searching yourself on Google or social media and seeing negative after negative after negative, then the whole thing's going to spiral. So if you're surrounded by negative people or by negative comments,
have you ever had fans reach out to you personally? Bagging you, giving you shit?
Well, they try. There's a few people that have tried to message. Obviously, the only reason I'd see them is because Facebook hides them away in some weird corner. And occasionally, I find myself, when you're bored, just dropping into them to delete them mainly. Because you can tell from the first line they're not going to be positive.
No.
But equally, there's people who will reach out and be positive and compliment you.
Right, okay.
So it's not just a one-way street. But yeah, from a mental health perspective, if all you're going to do is seek out and surround yourself with negativity, then that's a very dangerous place, very dangerous place to be.
Mm.
And again, it's, whether it's right or wrong, but part of the job is just accepting that people have paid their money to watch the game. That's their Saturday afternoon sort of outlet where they can rant and rave and get stuff off their chest after what may be a tough week at work for them. Mm. And if we happen to be the target of that, then it's just appreciating what their objectives are. And arguably they're shouting at us. They don't know us as individuals. So arguably they're having a go at us in the uniform. we take that uniform off, we could walk next to them down the street away from the game. They probably wouldn't know who we were.
Mm.
And that's happened. One of our refs did a game in Cardiff, ended up in a local pub afterwards, having a piss of all things next to a spectator. Spectator starts to slag off the referee, absolutely cans him.
Oh my.
Doesn't even realise that he's stood next to him having a piss, and he's the guy he's ranting to about it.
Oh my God.
So again, it's very much a uniform thing.
That is genius.
As opposed to them actually knowing us as individuals.
We spoke on the phone, and actually, when I approached you to come on the pod, you said you'd had mental health issues quite recently.
Yep.
Talk to me about that period. What happened?
Is to say strange would be an understatement. So 2018 September, I was due to go down to, well, I did go to Australia. So part of an exchange that we had to referee in their NRC competition. So I'd never been to Australia before, so really looking forward to it. There are loads of people who have been. Obviously got some pretty iconic things to do down there. And I was going for 2.5 weeks to ref 2 games. So a pretty cushy number.
That's cool,
to say that it's work, and have someone else pay for it, look after you when you're there and stuff.
Much better than how you're going at the moment. 4 games a day.
Games a day, all of them in London. Really looking forward to that. And look, it's not something that's unusual. So I've, through refereeing, been very lucky that prior to that, I'd been all sorts of places. I'd been to Japan twice, Malaysia, Dubai, South Africa, all the way around Europe, even to Russia. So we're well used to travelling to some pretty far-flung, really good places. So I had no reason to doubt this trip would be the same as any of the previous trips. 3 days out, when the big bag comes out from underneath my bed and I start to pack it as usual, from literally out of nowhere, the next minute I find myself sat there looking at the bag in floods of tears, not wanting to go.
Really?
Absolutely daunted by the prospect that I'm going so far on my own, despite the fact I've done it before and done it for rugby before. And all of a sudden, at that moment, it seemed like the worst thing ever. And this, I don't know whether it was that scared me or the fact that, I had no idea where it had come from and I had no control over it.
How did that progress?
The bag got packed. It was a horrible 3 days. Like the 3 days from when the bag got packed to when I got to Heathrow was just torturous. I was looking at every minute of every day trying to make it last as long as possible.
Wow.
Like it was going to be my last days and seconds and minutes here.
On Earth.
Not necessarily on Earth, but in this home environment that I'm familiar with,
right,
and that I like. The day actually travelling to Australia was fine. Give me something to do, something to focus on.
Of course.
It was fine. So the, whatever it was, 23-hour journey went pretty quick. I loved it. To be fair, I quite enjoy travelling. I like jumping through airports, being on planes.
Right. It's,
for some reason, that
gives you a thrill.
Yeah, I just like that. It's different. Mm. It's not your every day. Landed in Australia, Brisbane, checking at the hotel. As it happened, there'd been an international match there, so there were some officials that were there that I knew, so caught up with them for a few drinks. They were heading off the next day. Shut the door in my hotel room that evening, thinking, oh, we're here, it's been fine. Perhaps it was something or nothing, and very quickly realised, yeah, that wasn't. And pretty much every night that trip, days were fine, because you're busy, you can occupy yourself, you're surrounded by people. Put me in that hotel room at night with my own thoughts, and it was a disaster. So my mind started racing, heart pounding. Wasn't uncommon for me to find myself either in cold sweats or just crying myself to sleep.
And what were the thoughts?
See, this is where it gets really interesting. Like, as a scientist, it's all about process and rational thinking. In that very moment, I was the most irrational person you will ever meet. And he even talked to me at lunch the next day in Australia. I could have told you everything that was scaring me was irrational. And the chances of it happening were minuscule and that none of it had ever happened before. But in that moment, it felt so real. So the stuff was like, really, it could sound really pathetic saying it, but like, what happens if I lose my passport? Well, you get a new one clearly and you just come home a bit late.
Mm.
But that prospect petrified me of not being able to get home. What happens if the internet went down and I can't communicate with anyone ever again at home and I'm just completely cut off on my own out here? Those sorts of thoughts, anything that my brain could latch onto that would associate with not being able to get home, and that was it. It was all over it. And that's where the fear sort of stemmed from.
It's interesting because you wanted to go and referee. Yeah. Over, literally, like that. Something switched in your brain.
That's the biggest question I still get asked from the people that know about it and ask me about it. Like, what's the trigger? What caused it? And I'm literally like, I've no idea.
No. And you've done work. You've done work with psychologists.
100%. So, eventually got referred through, I think it's Cognacity, so the same system the RPA use. So really well looked after. Put in touch with the experts, the best at what they do, and so had those conversations. And there's no trigger that's apparent. So there's no big life event. So, was I like broken up from a relationship or new in a relationship? No. Was I about to lose my job or move house? Any of those big stresses? No. From a family perspective, dad wasn't well, but that wasn't new. There was no change there. So nothing really kicking off there. So all those big trigger things you can think about that could attribute to it, it was pretty much normal. Everything ticking along as you'd expect, which then adds to the frustration, I suppose, on my part, is where the hell has this just come from? And that realization, I suppose, looking back on it, that you don't know when it's going to hit, can hit anyone. And you may not have answers as to why. But you've then got to, as I learned over the months that followed, you've then got to learn to take back control.
Right.
Which is easier said than done.
Let's talk about that, because it wasn't just that one isolated incident where you went to Australia. No. As I understand it, you came back.
So you did the trip, got through it, and thought, happy days, there we go. Maybe that's it. It was a horrible 2.5 weeks. I never thought I'd say that about Australia. And the place is brilliant, the people are brilliant, but the experience, was tainted. But I thought, well, I've been there, done it, rocky road, but let's put it down to a one-off. And I've learned from it, was my thought. And initially it seemed true. So we came back, went to a European conference in Paris, fine. Went and did the first round of Europe in Italy, fine. So now you're thinking, okay, I'm back to familiar territory, jumping on planes, living out a suitcase for 2 days. Happy days, fine. Get to round two of Europe in Toulouse, a city that I've been to 6 times. So it's, you know it really well. Not like it's a new environment, new people. It hits again. So exactly the same. The Friday night, having landed there, soon as that hotel room door shut, it's exactly the same as Australia. And that's probably the point that scared me the most. Because then I was like, Jesus Christ, this isn't a one-off. And B, if this is genuinely an issue that I can't fix, then my refereeing days are going to be over. And that's then the end of a job, the end of a hobby, the end of dreams. Probably 10 years, well, 10 years before I thought it's going to end. It's
fascinating.
And that's petrifying.
Fascinating how the mind works, isn't it? Like, you would have had, because I had a similar experience with you in terms of anxiety, where actually... you have one thought, your brain picks out, you have thousands of thoughts every single day, yet your brain picks out the ones that mean a huge amount and that it knows is going to thrive because your limbic system is working really fucking hard. But do you know the kind of the stream of consciousness in your mind where it started at all? Because generally, it sounds like you went had one thought and then went down this very long, like windy, dark road to the end of a cul-de-sac where basically life is over quite quickly. That's hugely common.
Probably no copping point where whatever the thought it latched onto was, it was always to do with, right, let's think of how I could not be able to get home. That's always the start point. And it's always the start point when you're in a hotel room or any room on your own and it's dark outside. So like very rare, in fact never, during a day in daylight hours, even on my own, would those thoughts enter my mind. I suppose because you can go and do something and distract yourself very quickly, or you're surrounded by people. So it's always the set of circumstances where that spiral starts is always very similar that I found. From Australia through to Toulouse and then through to the other games that season that I didn't fulfill purely because of that.
So it had an impact on you actually going and doing games. Well, you did the game in Toulouse, right?
No.
Really?
The only way that I could calm myself and settle myself down was to book a flight at 4 a.m. to come home the next day.
Oh my lord.
So I didn't ref that game until
extraordinary.
So
what's the process? Do they fly out somebody immediately or one of the
assistants? So there's a reserve ref that travels with us. So they got an opportunity. So that's the one good thing that came out of it. If someone else got an opportunity they wouldn't have otherwise got. But yeah, from my perspective, that's the strange part about it as well. It's the second that I knew, because I was looking at it on my phone, that flight was booked for the next morning.
Everything was gone.
Literally. Even though I'm in the same hotel room, in the same city, still not at home, it's like the switch has gone off and my mind was at peace.
Wow.
So that was equally weird as to how that worked.
How many times did this happen?
So it happened in Australia, happened in Toulouse. That started the process of getting some help on it. It cost me my first international. So I didn't ref Romania, USA, for the same reason. But that was slightly different, as in I never even went. So I was driving back from, I'd run touch and I'd refereed a Premiership Cup game, I think in Exeter. I can tell you exactly where I was because I was on the M3 about to get onto the M25 to loop back around here to South London. And the second it dawned on me, having ref that game, that my next appointment was in Romania, and that's obviously the travel away from home, I just was crying at the wheel of my car trying to actually see where the hell I was going.
Wow.
So as not to crash. That was then a climax. That's when the counselling that I had in place at the time then changed, and Cognacity were putting, like, was sent to them.
How do you reflect back on it?
Mixed, because I still don't know where it came from. The scientist in me still wants to understand.
Of course.
Why did this suddenly happen? Because as I've said, there's no trigger event. All the stuff I was doing, I've done before. And yet, it still happened and come out of nowhere. So I really would love to understand that. But equally, I've got to accept that there probably will never be an explanation.
Mm.
And if it is, it's probably so long-winded with so many different components. Mm. And it still wouldn't change anything, even if you understood where it came from. The situation still is what it is, so you still need to learn to then live with and control it. And that's where the energy and the focus has gone.
That's fascinating, because essentially, if we look at the rut, you were in this rut where fucking hell, everything was on the line for you, and going and travelling, the thought of travelling was literally making you break down on the M3. And also meaning that you couldn't referee your first international game, cancelling games left, right and centre that weren't in the UK, or close, even though France is pretty close. Again, we can't even...
It's weird. So the games in France are closer, but you could put me on a train to Edinburgh or a game in Cornwall or where in like Colwyn Bay.
No fine. Problem.
The second you put C in the way, it seems.
Interesting.
That's when it became a problem. My own mind somehow managed to rationalise that being connected on a landmass is fine. Not being on that landmass and having some water in the way, despite the fact that planes, boats and trains exist, that became an issue for it.
How long did the rut last?
It probably took out the whole of that season. So the September from 2018 all the way through that season. So I only did 2 European games that year.
Blimey.
So you look at last season in Europe, just gone, I did 5 out of the 6 rounds. Now I wouldn't by any stretch say that those 5 games were necessarily easy, but it clearly was progress on the year before.
Absolutely.
So there's a positive in there.
Mm. You mentioned earlier taking back control.
Mm-hmm.
And no, we're not talking about Brexit, but what process did you go with Cognacity? I'm understanding the kind of psychology of getting yourself in a mental space where you might be going to, I don't know, Benetton Treviso, or going to Toulouse, or even going to, Japan or Argentina for international. Like, what process do you go to analyse your thoughts and be able to be comfortable enough to go and actually have a full season refereeing Europe?
That was the interesting thing about so the work that was done with the consultants was that the whole process of the treatment, if you like, that they went through wasn't to deal with those specific instances. It was to deal with, I suppose, life more generally. So they basically said there's no point us giving you a solution that works for travel, fixing that, because the problem can then rear its head somewhere else and you're back to stage one and you end up chasing your tail. So it took me probably 3 or 4 sessions with them to understand that the approach we're going for here is just like life holistically.
Right.
So every aspect of your life you could apply this to and it will give you control back. So it took me ages to detach, right, what we're trying to do here is come up with a solution for referee travel. It's like, that's not what we're trying to do. We're trying to come up with a solution that means in any aspect of your life, if you find yourself in one of these ruts, you've got the tools you need to take back control. I think the end conclusion I came to and that they kept running into me was be kinder to yourself, which seems very simple and it's a lot more complicated.
It's really, yeah.
But being kinder to yourself basically then linked to, you can have negative mental thoughts about anything. So take it, I thought I got flashed on the motorway the other day for speeding. And you can very quickly find yourself going, Jesus Christ, what happens if I do get a speeding ticket? What happens if it's then pointing my license? Or actually, no, I'm just disqualified because I was going so far. You can see how all those negative thoughts spiral and you end up with a catastrophic outcome in your mind in seconds.
Yeah.
So the whole premise was around stopping that ASAP. So it was basically viewing the brain and its pathways basically as like plasticine, and you can mold many different channels and you can control which way you want to go. So you can sit there and accept all those mental thoughts, or you can actually go, no, hang on a second, even if I did get caught speeding, it's the first time, and secondly, we'll deal with it when a ticket comes to the door. Trying to put some blocks in place so you never get to that catastrophic end outcome.
That's really interesting.
And that's how we went about trying to get control back.
Because in my experience with anxiety and what I've worked on is slightly different actually with my therapist, which is recognizing that they're just thoughts, and actually accept they come into your mind, accept that they are just thoughts.
Yeah.
But at the end of it, just shrug them off and learn and practice. Be like, okay, yeah, that could happen. I don't know. And that's okay.
I think that's, yeah, it's interesting you say that, because that was an element of what I also discussed, was like, that's instinctive, that's natural, that's how humans have evolved.
Of course.
That's you need those thoughts in some situations to stay alive.
So, survival, exactly.
So it's embracing them as, this is just the human mind doing its job, and then learning, as you say, to contextualise them, shrug them off, or basically say, right, if that comes to fruition, we'll deal with it then. And if it does come to fruition, I can, or the people I know, will be able to deal with that scenario.
Were there any other techniques and tools?
They were the main. There's obviously the stuff that you practiced anyway that we do from a refereeing perspective anyway. So like, you're about to do a TMO referral. Well, let's take 10 seconds here to just have some deep breaths and chill out.
Oh,
so
right.
there's all different triggers. So that sort of stuff is applicable. Some of it just was basically writing it down. Dear diary sort of stuff, as a means of ranting and offloading. And sometimes actually reading it back to yourself is enough to... I found myself laughing at myself.
100%.
That has an impact.
It does, yeah.
That helps. That almost puts that little voice in your head in its place.
It's really good for insecurities, that, actually, I found. I've been insecure about a few things recently in relationships, and I was like having to write them down, and I was looking at them like... Okay, I've written that down in the moment, but that is ridiculous.
Yeah.
And that's fascinating.
Yeah, so that sort of stuff, and sometimes even ranking a score next to it. So you write that down, like, what are the chances of this happening?
Oh, right.
What? And then you read it back and you're like, okay, well, that sounds dramatic, but the chance of that ever happening, non-existent. Just trying to, anything you can to contextualise it. So there's a few different strategies there.
Fascinating. You're in a much better place now. Clearly, you've been refereeing Europe.
Last year in Europe went well. And interesting, we've just had a pandemic that's obviously shut down air travel. Even in my deepest, darkest thoughts of worrying about how I couldn't get home, a pandemic never even featured.
Never.
So you sort of sit there laughing at yourself going, well, the one thing that's actually happened that could have actually affected people getting from A to B, even in my darkest hour, did I not even think that was possible? So that just, again, gives you a bit of context. At least it gives me some context to laugh at myself.
I wanted to move on to onto being gay and in being gay in rugby, because obviously we've had a couple of ex-players come out as gay, and Nigel Owens refereeing currently.
Yeah.
I spoke to a friend about what I think I should, what she thinks I should ask you. She's a big rugby nerd, and she'll love that she's been mentioned on the podcast anyway. But she obviously saw your the Rainbow Laces video you did, which essentially was kind of a, as we talked about it before the podcast,
yeah.
It was a bit of a big reveal. When it really
apparently.
Like, how do you reflect on it?
So the video was then, just for Rainbow Laces weekend. And the next thing you know, you've got all the media outlets reporting it as a coming out story. And you sort of like, well, hang on a second, this is 3 years after the actual event. So it was portrayed in a very different way to what that video actually was. I think on one level, fine, great, there's that level of interest. But equally, if there had been no interest, then it had just been taken as a video about Rainbow Laces and
of course.
And nothing else, you'd have been like, well, that would be equally as good, because then there's an element of, right, actually this is now just normalised and isn't a big headline grabbing event. So there was an element of frustration on my part that that's how it was branded, but the video itself I think did a lot of good in its own right.
100%. And I imagine post that video coming out, you've had a huge amount of support, right? It's almost just being like, well, okay, great, what?
Exactly. It was the same reaction I got when I actually came out many years before that video, which was either people who didn't care, which is a fantastic response to get, trust me, and to those who go out their way to be positive or supportive. And then clearly there's the messages that you get from people who are in the closet themselves, having their own battles, and who have seen the video and taken strength from it. There's one person on the back of it, it wasn't even him, it was his mum that contacted me and said that he'd been able to come out as a result of it.
So, how does that feel?
That's the whole reason of doing it.
Yeah.
So like I always said, because like Nick Heath was a guy I did the interview with, and he's like, why haven't you talked about this before? Well, no one's asked. So I made a very conscious decision that I would talk, but I wouldn't drive the agenda.
No, of course.
So if someone wants to have an interview, wants to chat about something, I'm more than happy to have
very
a conversation.
Interesting point. Yeah, why have you spoken before? I've just never been asked.
So
great.
And you go back to being an introvert.
Yeah,
I'm not about to go blow my own trumpet in that. So that he asked, I gave the interview, and I was always clear the reason I would do it is because of that benefit of it. Because I know from when I was in the closet, the interviews that I watched, the newspaper articles I read, or the vlogs from just openly gay couples that I watched, inspired me, gave me confidence. So it'd be wrong of me not to give that back, if you like, to other people, to hopefully take some confidence from.
Rugby is very accepting. We're actually quite lucky with I call it our sport, because it's my number one sport. I think sport in general has got a massively long way to go with being openly gay, etc., or not even openly, being gay in general.
Yep.
Like, what are your thoughts on sports and LGBTQ?
Where to start?
That is a very open-ended question for a reason. Yeah,
yeah, you can go anywhere with that. I think the culture that rugby has, the values rugby have, clearly helps. Whether you're talking about LGBT, whether you're talking about female participation, anything, I think the values of it clearly help. And one of the linked to that question is, people ask me, well, what does sport need to do for like a player to be able to come out? And I'm like, that shouldn't be the motivating factor here. Sport should be asking itself, as should society, like, what can we do better? Like, okay, we're good, but we can always do things better. So what do we need to do as a sport, as a society, to make it as inclusive an environment and culture as possible? And provided you do that, you can do no more. And it's then down to the individual whether they want to and are willing to come out. It shouldn't be a case of we need to do more because no players feel comfortable to come out. It should be a case of we should always be doing more in whatever aspect it is, to make it just to be true to rugby's values. Nothing beyond that. And if sport and rugby keeps doing that, then that's all it can do. Because the reaction I got within sport was really positive. So it's clearly doing things well. Doesn't mean it can't do them better.
Everybody has their stories about when they do. Well, everybody who is gay. have their stories about how they come out and the different impact, the different pressures, levels of anxiety. Obviously, Nigel Owens has been very public about how it affected his life.
Yeah.
But I suppose quite nicely, your stories, when we spoke about it for the first time, I was expecting, and that's my like ignorance and I suppose naivety around the subject. So you will need to excuse that. But your story is quite nice. It was just normalised, which is obviously how it really should be, but it's not.
Yeah. So from a coming out perspective, like the actual process to come out was long for me. There's like two full starts and then I did come out. So I was going to do it when I was in pharma, then got the job at Twickenham and just felt uncomfortable in a completely new environment coming out to people that some of them I've only just met. So then another 2 years later is when I actually came out. So from my perspective, again, linked to the mental health piece, even when I was in the closet, I wouldn't say I was unhappy. Clearly I'm happier now, but I was still happy when I was in the closet. It wasn't none of those mental health challenges that some people face reared their head for me. I was in a great career, refereeing was taken off, surrounded by loads of good friends at uni and a new job. I was loving life. So even though, yes, there were some dark days because you're in the closet and you're ultimately living a lie, I wouldn't say it had an impact in terms of making me noticeably unhappy or anxious about anything or depressed. Mm. And that's the same as life generally, isn't it? There's always peaks and troughs, whatever you're looking at. So that journey in itself, I suppose you can say I was lucky. That I didn't have those trials and tribulations that some people unfortunately go through. And then having come out, literally business as usual, which was grand. In fact, the only criticism I get for it is the fact that the message that I sent to tell the rest of the lads was sent, I think, at 6 a.m. from an airport. So most of them got woken up by their phone pinging at 6 a.m, not really appreciating the good morning call when I told them I was gay before I turned off to get on a plane to go on holiday.
Talk to me about that. That's really interesting. Off the cuff?
I always knew I was going to do that.
Right, okay.
The one that I didn't know how I was going to do it was telling parents.
Yes.
So I couldn't actually say the words. So I ended up on an iPad, on like the whiteboard, just writing on it, "I'm gay." Turn it around and show them. Because I couldn't actually say it. And it's the biggest...
Why not?
I don't know whether, I think, is it the biggest regret or the biggest embarrassment? It's the very people that I doubted and that probably delayed me coming out, but those closest to me. I genuinely didn't want anything to affect that relationship with either my closest friends or my parents.
Of course, yeah. Natural, though.
And in hindsight, you look at it and go, that's utterly stupid, because those are the very people that aren't going to give a damn.
No.
And that unconditional love piece. Mm. Yet they're the very people that I was the most scared about telling. Which is weird how your mind works when you're in the closet. It's almost throwing reasons at you not to come out.
You've literally physically could not say the words.
Couldn't say it. So just, flicked it around on a whiteboard.
And what was it? Like, what was the reaction?
same old. Mums always know, don't they?
Yeah.
So that was the same old. She's like, I had a... Had a suspicion. And to be fair, that was a delayed reaction. Like 24 hours later was when I got a barrage of questions.
Really?
All good-natured, but I think it's just that initial, still a shock to them, clearly. 24 hours later, sat down, conversation, questions. And then it's been, for me, it's been absolutely fine ever since. Mm.
Fascinating.
Different.
Very different, yeah. I mean, you hear some, you really do hear some, and you know this better than I do, but hear some stories where the torment people go through is just extraordinary.
Yes, for me it was interesting how the balance switched. Like, so you spend your time in the closet going, well, I can't come out because of all these perceptions that may change of me. And then it gets to a point where I was surrounded by people who either married, due to be married, in a relationship, sharing their highs and lows with people, making futures with loved ones. I was like, hang on, I want some of that.
Mm.
And I can't do that if I'm living a lie and not being true to myself. So the scales then tip completely the other way. And it's like, well, 100%, I now have to come out. I want to come out. because I want to start sharing my life with someone, making those memories with someone. It's interesting how that balance over time changed.
Mm.
And then you come out purely for, well, it's purely selfish. It's purely for my,
of course,
for my benefit, and that's completely how it should be.
I'm gonna edit the next part out because I've got 5 questions I want to ask you.
Quick fire
today. I forgot to put in. Fascinating. I've got 5 quick fire questions that I didn't actually. Well, I quite like this part because I haven't told you about any of them, which is fantastic. So it's going to be off the cuff.
meant to be good at this.
Yeah, well, these are questions I ask. Well, everybody coming on in season 2 now. So 30 seconds to a minute on each. Could be longer, but
yeah.
let's not go into War and Peace.
Not one word answers then.
Yeah. What's your favourite book and why?
My favourite book and why? So a book by Viktor Frankl, A Man's Search for Meaning.
Very good.
I thought that was a really interesting read, and there's one bit from it that sticks out, which is, I'm not going to quote it because I probably can't get the quote right, but it's like the last of the human freedoms. It's like man chooses how he can respond to any given situation. So irrespective what the provocation is, what's done to you, you still control how you react to that situation. And I think that's the most pertinent message that I took from that. Yeah, whatever life throws at you, whatever people are saying or doing, so you go back to refereeing, the negative stuff being thrown at you, you still choose how you react to that. You can either roll with it and follow the negativity and think they're right, or you can react in a manner where I'm going to prove you a lot wrong, and here's my learning and positive reaction to it. But yeah, definitely that book.
Fabulous book. I mean, if people are listening, they want a good book. I mean, it's unbelievable, that book.
It's interesting, his reaction to it as well. So like when he was told, like, what, 10 million sales? Yeah. You must be ecstatic. He's like, if 10 million people have felt the need to pick up a book entitled A Man's Search for Meaning, I don't think that's positive.
No.
And it's really interesting, his stance on that as well.
Mm. I've just said not War and Peace in the answers, but like, a lot of people with mental health issues that I've spoken to bring it back round to the whole feeling of being a bit lost. They don't quite have a purpose and a meaning or fulfillment in their life, and that plagues them. And it's why self-improvement and self-help, the self-help industry and self-improvement industry is so big, is because you kind of, you're geared up throughout your life to know what career you want. And obviously your career as in refereeing has a shelf life, so it's going to be interesting for you. You're kind of lucky that you've got a pharmaceutical background or a science background. That's something you can fall back on. But people's career, like, you leave uni and you're like, right, well, actually you're in school and they're like, what do you want to do for a career? I don't fucking know. Go to uni, what do you want to do for a career?
Still don't know.
Yeah. You leave, you, and everything's plugged towards this whole career idea. And actually, it should be, in my opinion, what is your purpose? What are your passions? How can you build a life around your purposes and passions? And remembering that purpose is very fluid, actually.
Yeah.
But it battered me with my mental health. It's just like, wow. See my girlfriend who's a lawyer, and it's like, great, she's got a career. She could be a lawyer for the rest of her life. I don't. What do I want to do? It's really unsettling. So, yeah.
It's the pressure that comes, isn't it? As you say, all those milestones. Yeah. You should know this by then. It's like, life's, yeah, it's definitely not one size fits all.
No, it's how you transcend that conversation, I suppose.
And going back to books, a lot of people are going to be disappointed I didn't say the law book. being the geek that I am. So
I'm glad you didn't say that. Because, my word. What lesson have you learned in your life that you know is true, but you kind of hate?
What, that mum's always right?
that could be it. Yeah.
Exactly that, yeah.
I had David Birtwistle on the other day who said, eat your veggies.
Eat your veggies. I'm still fighting that one. Yeah, mum's always right, partner's always right.
Yeah.
However much I back myself to be able to construct an argument to convince most people, but those are two people that would not fall for it and you have to book. You never admit it, but until about a month later.
Yeah. Your friend who's having a tough time at the moment picks up the phone. He rings you and says he's having a really bad day today. What do you say?
Jesus. Yeah, good one. I'm not sure I'd necessarily say anything. I'd be like, talk to me.
Okay.
I think that goes back to analytical...
That is saying something.
That analytical part of me, which is, I just talk to me. You've clearly called me. You want to offload something or run something by me. So yeah, I think the best thing I could do in that scenario would be listen to them.
Yeah.
And then act as a soundboard. Mm. I think most people that know me well enough know that as much as I will listen, I'm very much someone that if you're asking me for a view on something, you'll get that view. So I'm not someone who will just give you the answer you want to hear.
Mm.
I'm going to give you the answer that I think you need to hear, whether you like it or not.
Mm.
And I think there's a difference there.
Yeah.
I think it's a good friend will give you that honest answer, and a friend will just tell you what you thinks you need to hear, which doesn't always help.
I agree. Yeah, it's that question I also find is quite interesting, getting the, well, understanding the answer from people, where there's quite a fine line between the empathy versus sympathy.
Mm-hmm.
in that when it comes to mental health, it's like not always being too solutions focused, which a lot of people can be. It's like, right, we're going to fucking fix this. I mean, sometimes my mum can be the worst, right? Like, if I'm in a bunch, she's like, right, this is what we're going to do to fix it. And I'm like, can we please slow down? Can you just put your arm around me and let me talk?
Yep, 100%.
People get that wrong a lot.
Yeah.
When you're struggling with something, struggling yourself, what's your go-to? Like, who do you go to? What do you tend to do? Have you got any releases?
That varies. So the go-tos would either be two uni mates, mother, or the other half. And then aside from that, if none of them are available, I didn't really want to talk to anyone, then I'm just going to throw myself out the door and go on a run.
Nice.
Just very simple like that. Mm. But just, yeah, the fresh air, I suppose watching the world go by as you run past it. For some reason, that gives me that calm that I need, that time that I need. So yeah, that's my go-to in those scenarios.
Nice. Like that.
But going back to the anxiety piece from travel, the very dangerous lesson that I didn't have to learn but nearly did was I very quickly realised that the nights that were easier were the ones where we'd gone for a meal the night before and had a few to drink. Because you're not necessarily, you're sort of on the way to being drunk. Those nights were fine. You fell asleep instantly. Woke up the next day, cracked on, no issues.
Problem is, that's a
dangerous cycle to go down.
Really dangerous.
So very glad that I had enough awareness and just from circumstance around to know that that's not a credible path to go down.
Mm.
So that's not a go-to.
No, very good. No, I like that. You're lying on your deathbed, looking back at your life. What are you most proud of?
What am I most proud of? Being honest.
Expand.
So, the closeted LGBT stuff, you need to be honest with yourself and others earlier. So taking that forward, if I hadn't have had that experience, there's no way I would have reached out from a mental health perspective as early as I did. There's no way I would have been as honest as I needed to be earlier. And the fact you're honest earlier has helped me, instead of having it protracted over years when you're just living a lie pretending that everything's fine, that's had a more positive impact. And then being able to give that advice to others, as I said, going back to the previous question, be able to give honest advice to people, I think is a massive benefit. It can save a lot of years of turmoil or unnecessary suffering. And there's too many examples where you just see people just store things away into a pressure cooker that then just explodes. So yeah, that being honest to yourself mainly. If you're honest with yourself, you can then, it's amazing what doors that opens. Going back to your question about like, what's your purpose? It's like, if you're honest with yourself as to what that is, you can then find yourself in a career or a job role that you enjoy, that you get fulfillment from.
What's your purpose?
What's my purpose? you have to enjoy what you do.
Mm.
And it's an interesting question when you look from a refereeing perspective, because what is my purpose refereeing? So, yes, I get to challenge my skill set on a daily basis and apply it in a very unique environment. And don't get me wrong, I enjoy that, which is why I still do it. But at the end of any given game or any given month or season, what have I actually achieved?
Mm.
And that's a question that I can't answer. Go back to being a pharmaceutical scientist, your purpose is very clear. A, I enjoy this because it's intellectually stimulating and I'm pitting myself at the forefront of science, but also the stuff that we're doing is helping people. It's giving people a better quality of life. It's curing illnesses, or it's research that in the long term is going to help that be achieved. That's a clear sense of purpose.
Mm.
That you have less of that from a refereeing perspective.
I never thought of that. That's very true. If you get to the end of the season, what have you achieved? Well, you might have. Well, that's not necessarily true.
You could have got some prolific. Okay,
you could have refereed the World Cup final, for example.
I don't get wrong. That's a great achievement. But in terms of a lasting impact.
Of course, yeah.
I mean, some people may not be motivated by that, but some people may not. That may not be something that they're chasing or seeking. But for me, that's the biggest question that I'm still trying to answer from a refereeing perspective. Is, yes, it's enjoyable. Yes, it's going to be good while it lasts. But if you're chasing that deeper purpose and that deeper sense of fulfillment, and you can look back and, well, what is my legacy from this? You're not going to get that from refereeing for me. But from the pharma science stuff, to name one example, then you will. And that's why the master's I did in sports psychology may be quite interesting, exploring how I can take that down the line in the future.
Mm. Final question, and it's the only question, well, I haven't asked this question to anybody yet because it's not really in their area, but what the fuck is going on with the rugby, with the breakdown laws right now?
Am I meant to be able to answer that?
Yeah.
Is it not going to be reassuring if I can't? Yeah. Lots is going on.
Christ, I've never seen so many bloody penalties.
Yeah, so yeah, we hope that's going to settle down. It's another one where, so the motivating factor is clearly good because they want to try and make it safer. So the whole idea of the current breakdown laws is how they're now being applied is the height of the breakdown should be higher.
Yeah.
So people's heads and necks less exposed, so a safer breakdown. People not being cleared out from the side, so less twisting of knees and stuff. So it's motivated by good intentions. But yeah, the bedding in period, as we always knew from watching in New Zealand, you're going to get that spike in penalties.
Yeah, and the jackal lifting the ball is an interesting one
from an
attacking perspective, because the ball's more in their court there, right?
Yeah, and the attack versus defence balance has shifted now. So if you looked pre-lockdown, pre this re-law emphasis, I think you'd probably be looking at 80% of penalties going against the defence. Mm. So it's all attack, attack, attack. Whereas now it's been a lot more, it's a level playing field. It's been balanced out. And the penalties have come down to sometimes 50, 60% split. So a lot more even. Which is, again, from a safety perspective, as I touched on that piece, but it's encouraging teams to do things differently.
Mm.
So like either offload the ball, keep it alive. Seen a lot more tap and goes. You're seeing ruck speed, I think, has gone down from over 3 seconds to in the mid 2 point something seconds. So you're getting really quick ball, so there's other consequences of it, which once it's bedded in and we've adapted as referees, but also once the players and coaches have adapted, it should not only lead to a safer game but a more entertaining spectacle.
One thing I've also noticed, this is kind of unrelated to the breakdown, but just and last thing, which is from a rugby north perspective. 5 metres out, you're now seeing players tap and go as opposed to taking a 5 metre scrum. And do you know what? That's literally just come in since the restart,
yep,
from what I've seen. Why? Any indication as to why that's going on?
I've absolutely no idea.
It's weird.
We've noticed that as well. And we have, I can't answer that question.
Never seen it before.
Because obviously, most of them would kick a line out and take the line out because I think from a refereeing perspective we're a lot less involved in that. They see it as a lot less of a lottery than a scrum. Don't get me wrong, it's great, it's a lot more positive, long may it continue. It's caused us other problems with people trying to dummy that quick tap 5 metres out to draw them offside. But yeah, it's certainly better that you saw some good tries from the game at Quinn's at the weekend where players out of the blue tap and go. And it's what you want, because the best sort of attack in rugby is when the defence isn't expecting it.
Nobody
wants a set defence.
Yeah. Nobody wants a game full of fucking reset scrums as well.
Yeah, don't say that to the scrub noses.
No.
But I think if we're honest with ourselves, in the entertainment business,
yeah,
you don't want the game absorbed by scrums and reset scrums. And it's interesting, one of the law variations they considered in lockdown was removing scrum, or at least removing reset scrums.
Really?
So you've got one chance for it to work. If it doesn't,
of course,
probably a free kick.
Free
off kick. We go.
Free kick, presumably to the team
that was due to put it in.
Due to put it in.
Yeah. And they can't take a scrum off that.
No. Why wasn't that brought in?
I think there's a whole package of them which just didn't have support. Because I suppose you can't. The scrum is fundamental to rugby, so you don't want to completely take it away. Who knows? You may get there at some point.
I hope.
I was all for it.
Yeah, I'd be all for that. Reset scrums as a back, but also just as somebody who watches religiously, like, it is a fucking pain in the ass. And for somebody also who doesn't quite, well, I understand hinging, but often you kind of look.
I'm glad you understand it. Yeah. I'm not sure.
Well,
I do.
You kind of look at the scrum and you're like, this could go either way. It is a total lottery. So God knows how you do it.
Yes, yeah, a good question. Don't know how we do. I think we try and keep it as simple as possible.
Reassuring.
So we're all about pitches, yeah. So we basically say to the players, look, there's no point being so technical that you catch us out.
Yeah,
because that's in no one's interest. Yeah. You want to paint us a really simple picture, go forward on both sides, and I think everybody then expects and understands that decision. Mm. But yeah, the Women's Premiership, I think, when it comes back, may well be trialling that law from a scrummaging perspective. So if they do, it'd be interesting to see how that goes and what impact it's perceived to have. Just as a trial basis.
Very nice. Enough nosing. Thank you so much for coming on. We've done an hour and 23 minutes.
There we go.
Wow.
It's longer than a game of rugby.
One for the rugby purists, this one, in many senses. But thank you so much for your time and being so open and honest about mental health and refereeing. And it's such an insight that a lot of people, well, you don't really get that much apart from Barnsley or JP Dore or whatever going on, rugby tie, etc. But yeah, really, really appreciate it.
Brilliant. Thank you for having me on.
Okay, so I know that the point of this podcast is that we get men talking. We facilitate a platform with which men can come on and talk, often in the most brutal way, about their battles with their mental health. But I'm still often in awe of the way men come on and talk about the most difficult and vulnerable parts of their life. And I know that talking about being gay in professional sport is quite a daunting task. It's getting a lot better, and rugby, we're fortunate in rugby that we offer and provide a very inclusive space, and it's widely promoted, but it still amazes me that people like Craig are wanting to be so open and candid. So Craig, you're an absolute legend. Thank you for being so open and vulnerable with your truth. For the rugby purists too, I hope you can make sense of the new breakdown interpretations, because I certainly can't. But thanks Craig for shedding some referee light and some obligatory rugby nausing went on. It was a real pleasure to sit down with you. Next week, we're going to release one of the most amazing episodes we've ever done. I sit down with disability coach and dystonia sufferer James Sutliff. You will be in total awe of this man's story and journey. I really cannot recommend you listen to this enough. It is one of the most unbelievable stories we've ever had the pleasure of exploring, and it is a remarkable episode. So I'm so excited for you to listen to that next week. See you then, and have a very, very good week. Take care.